Case number 56579, Bryce v. Second Judicial District et al. If parties are ready to proceed, please do so. And for the record, please state names and if you wish to reserve any time.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Bill Janeau on behalf of the petitioner, Mr. and Mrs. Bryce. Good morning, members of the court. As you're aware, this case arises at the district court level from the granting of a motion for partial summary judgment in a medical negligence case.
That's the issue I have right off the bat. What does this order mean? What does it mean to you as the plaintiff's attorney in this case?
The order of the district court?
Yes.
It precludes the ability of the case to go forward. The order means that in all practical consequence, in order to move the case forward to a jury trial, the case is limited to $50,000, and the cost of the experts to go forward would exceed that. And the reality is that my client will not get a jury trial. That's the consequence of the order. The order as written, frankly, does not explain or give any basis for understanding, number one, which portion of 41503 the court was referring to, whether it was the rebuttable presumption, whether it was the issue of whether or not there was gross negligence involved by the physician, all which were raised in the motions. And thirdly, the order of the court does not discuss the issue of the two affidavits submitted on behalf of the plaintiff, which related to those basic factual issues which are contained within 41503, which are questions of fact for the jury to consider.
Well, is it your understanding, though, if this case goes forward and we don't do anything, how would this play out at trial in terms of, is there a rebuttable presumption that would be yours to overcome, or are you saying it's determined as a matter of law that you may not recover more than $50,000? The order strikes me as ambiguous on that point.
My understanding of the order, Justice Pickering, is that we can go to trial, the jury will sit and hear all the evidence, can bring in a verdict for the true value of the case, and the court would impose the $50,000 cap. It's not ambiguous to me in the sense that we are capped at $50,000 in moving this case forward.
And did anyone, seek to clarify the order?
No. There was no effort to clarify the order at all.
Is the follow-up care, is that something that necessarily has to be determined as a matter of fact, as opposed to what the judge did here?
Would you ask me again, please?
The determination of follow-up care. That's indicated in Judge Adams's order, and he made the determination that this was follow-up care.
Correct.
Are you contending that that's something that's a question of fact that should be better left to a jury?
Yes, not only contending now, but it was contended in our opposition. Both Dr. Reagan and Dr. Kabesh, in their affidavits, provided sworn testimony that, in their opinion, because there was a four-day gap from the initial emergent treatment within the trauma center to the time where he was admitted to the floor, monitored for 4 days, his neurological function still had not returned, and the physician, who is the real party in interest in this case, made the decision to come in and do a second surgery. Both Reagan and Kabesh, who are board-certified, very, very well-respected neurological surgeon and an orthopedic surgeons, their opinion was he was stable, non-emergent, and the issue then becomes the rebuttable presumption of whether or not it was related to the original injury as opposed to a new and different injury or a new or different
And if it's follow-up care, it's necessarily related?
It's a question of fact,
right?
Clearly.
And so you're saying he conclusively determined that the cap will apply?
Correct.
And did away with the presumption?
Correct.
Yeah. But, Mr. Janae, this is before us on a writ. Could you explain to me why it is that extraordinary relief should even be considered by this court?
We bring the case for the because of the writ, because for the case to go forward, I mean, what it in reality does, it's an issue that has to be decided by this court. It applies all over the state. And the consequence here is in every case where we have this issue under this statute, this issue is going to come up because, frankly, the statute is not well written. And it has a general rule, an exception, then a sub-exception to the exception, and then underneath an overall issue of whether or not the doctor was conducting, whether there was gross negligence involved. So there has to be some clarification. It's an issue that is every time a trauma case comes into every lawyer's office in the state, this issue has to be resolved. The statute either has to be declared unconstitutional, clarified, or...
Well, for purposes of a writ, Mr. Genet, are you asking this court to interpret the statute to say that these issues that are raised by the statute are questions of fact rather than questions of law?
That is certainly one part of our argument, Your Honor, that our argument is twofold. Number one, that for the purposes of the writ, this court, the lower court, has made an error that has to be corrected, and it needs to be ordered to correct that error factually, because there are material issues of fact in this case. The secondary argument, obviously, are the constitutional issues that were not in the court's order. They're not addressed whatsoever. I have no way of knowing what the court's consideration was other
this
than
court
obviously
normally
it was
wouldn't read the this court normally wouldn't reach the constitutional questions until there's a verdict first, at least on writ relief cases.
Yes.
So for purposes of the writ, could you address the court should consider the writ and what remedy needs to be or what interpretation needs to be addressed to send you all back to the district court so that this issue is tried as a question of fact?
Certainly. In terms of the writ, Your Honor, is that the court has entered an order that we believe is in error. And if it's allowed to go forward, the case is currently, its current status, if it's allowed to go forward, our client has no basis for relief. He can't go forward.
So your argument is that the district court's summary judgment order is in error because it treated the assessment under the statute as an issue of law.
Correct. Absolutely. That the issues raised within the motion and the opposition, the court made decision, the court's order, as a matter of law, said that there are no issues of fact, when clearly the court was presented within the motion and the opposition clear issues of fact. So the error of the court is that the court has applied the statute as a matter of law and had to decide underlying facts which were in contention by experts, board-certified medical experts, when the court, frankly, should not have done it.
Now, Mr. Genet, I think your other argument was, if I understood it correctly, was there's like a public policy issue here. There's all these emergency room cases. I don't know if there's lots of lawsuits, but assuming there is, that the courts and the lawyers and the public need some guidance as to how this follow-up care issue plays out and what the rules are on that. So that was part of your argument as well.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
But I'm trying to understand in terms of the writ issue. There are many cases where a judge may grant a partial summary judgment in the face, at least of one side's view, that there are genuine issues of material fact that preclude it. What would distinguish this case on that issue from the whole host of those? The issues are always important to the litigants, and I'm concerned about proper writ relief and the delay it buys, you know, and the frankly, the increase in number of cases here. As a matter of policy, how do you cabin writ relief in this case as opposed to any case where a partial summary judgment is erroneously granted? It could be, as the case proceeds forward, that you would convince Judge Adams of the error of his ways. There's a host of things that could happen that would alter the presumption aspect of this case. And I'm not truly convinced that the presumption issue is that far-reaching statewide. I understand your constitutional challenge may have a larger audience, but this presumption issue and how you read his order and whether or not this defeats your claim, could you tell me why we should take writ relief on that case, on that issue?
Because in a typical case, Justice Pickering, the granting of a motion for summary judgment is the court's making a decision about in our field, in medical negligence or in personal injury, whether there's duty, causation, or so on, which this court has very well constructed guidance for us to use and for the courts to use. In this particular case, the application is of a statute that is relatively new and this court has never considered. And the statute does not read clearly. It has many portions of it that need more clarification in terms of which we've talked about, the exceptions and the sub-exceptions. And as a consequence, in this particular case, the order out of this court, he makes a blanket application under facts that are in dispute. He makes a blanket application of this particular statute.
And so the particular error that you would ask us to correct, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is in reviewing a motion for partial summary judgment under 41503 sub 3, you should recognize that the determination of whether to apply the presumption or not can, and in many instances will be, a question of fact for the jury to decide on special interrogatory. Is that what you would like us to order?
Clearly.
Okay. But, Mr. Genet, could this case not proceed to trial, in fact, with a special interrogatory wherein the jury might find or make a damages award, as you suggest, that would be appropriate in this case, notwithstanding the fact that the judge, even given this order, could reduce it, reduce the award to what he perceives as the $50,000 cap, and then we would have a full and complete record before us to review?
It certainly can do that. Now, the practical consequences of doing that is Mr. and Mrs. Bryce are faced in this. It goes to the issue of getting a fair jury trial. The costs are enormous in these types of cases. It will take 4 or 5 experts to get the case through trial. The costs are going to range somewhere between $50,000 to maybe $85,000 to get the case to trial. And the whole time, not knowing, as we currently sit with this order, the order applies 41503. Damages are restricted to $50,000.
And this judge wouldn't even give an instruction on follow-up care. In other words, there won't even be an interrogatory on follow-up care according to this order. I mean, if I were the judge and this was my order and you said to me, Judge Sherry, I want you to give an interrogatory on follow-up care, I'd say, Mr. Genet, I ruled. Didn't you read my order?
Oh, I would want an instruction on rebuttal presumption. I'd want an instruction on follow-up care. My experts wouldn't be allowed to testify under this current order as to whether or not this was follow-up care, whether the emergent situation had resolved or not. So there's a whole host of issues that the plaintiff faces as a burden just to get to a jury in this case when I have to sit down with my clients and say, look, we're capped at $50,000 as we currently sit here. The economic consideration of spending $85,000 in a case that it appears that you're capped at $50,000 is a very, very difficult, and it goes to the issue of the right to this jury trial. So that risk falls on the plaintiff when it seems to be more reasonable to consider at this point whether or not the blanket application of 41503 under the facts as they arise in this case is clearly an error that needs to be corrected, and clarification in terms of the application of the statute would seem to be appropriate statewide so that we have guidance to know in all courts, all district court judges who would have to craft instructions and make decisions on what evidence would be admissible in these types of cases would have guidance.
Mr. Genet, you're under 3 minutes. You want to reserve your remaining time?
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Tiffany Pagny. I'm with Lemons, Grundy, and Eisenberg, and we represent Dr. Digby Preston in this case.
Counsel, I'm going to ask the same question that was asked of Mr. Genet. Please tell this court how you read the judge's order with respect to application of the statute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The way I read the order, and I've got the language of the order here, is that the district court determined that section 41503(3) applied in this case. He specifically states NRS 41503(3) states the cap would apply to a medical condition arising during the course of the follow-up care that is directly related to the original traumatic injury. The way I read this is that he is saying their rebuttable presumption applies.
It's really the next paragraph that I'm concerned about. The court finds a care given on September 14, 2008 was follow-up care directly related to the original traumatic injury. Doesn't that, in fact, preclude consideration of a matter that might be better suited for the jury to make?
I don't believe so, because I think the undisputed facts in this case would apply to that rebuttable presumption. And when he's saying directly related to the original injury, if we look at the actual language of the statute, it is a little bit unclear. I'll agree with Mr. Genet on that. There is Section 3AB says a medical condition arises during the course of the follow-up care treatment that is directly related to the original traumatic injury. But when you go down, it, for purposes of the rebuttable presumption, there has to be a showing that it was the result of the original traumatic injury. So there's a different standard for whether the presumption applies, versus whether the section applies, and whether or not the cap applies contained within that statute.
So you would say there's an additional issue of fact for the jury to decide under Judge Adams' decision before he would apply the cap?
Absolutely, and I think those are where the undisputed facts come into, or I'm sorry, the disputed facts come into play. Because if you're, there's no dispute, as I understand it, as to the original care, the original immediate traumatic care that was rendered. And that's where subsection 1 comes into play. Where there's a claim that there's negligence is in the follow-up care. It's that second surgery that's performed 3 days later, and whether or not certain things should have been done at that time. Those are all arguments to be made to refute that rebuttable presumption that this cap should apply.
So in other words, you don't believe that Mr. Genet's client is in any way limited by Judge Adams' order to a $50,000 recovery?
I think the rebuttable presumption applies, absolutely, and it's their burden to over-exemption. So I think
which they could do so, which they could do at trial.
Correct.
So let me make this clear. So his experts are going to be able to testify at this trial. There's going to be an interrogatory on follow-up care, on rebuttable presumptions. So the jury's going to make these findings. And then if it's a $1 million verdict, it'll be $1 million if, in fact, they find that it's not follow-up care and that his experts are correct.
There would be a jury instruction as to the rebuttable presumption issue, Your Honor. I think the follow-up care, that this was follow-up care, has been established, and I don't believe that was disputed, that this is follow-up care as defined by the statute. That doesn't mean that this cap's going to apply if they can refute it.
What if his experts say this isn't follow-up care? I think that's what he was saying, that his experts have said this isn't necessarily follow-up care because there was a delay in the treatment.
I'm sorry, I'm not following. I don't believe that's what the contentions were, Your Honor. It was, if you look at the statute, you have the same doctor who performs the initial surgery, performs follow-up care. There's a presumption if it's related, and their own expert says it's related, and I've cited the his language in my brief at page, section BA, his own expert said that the injury caused to Mr. Bryce by the second surgery was related to the original traumatic injury.
So there's a relation. Follow-up care, though. It says related, but not doesn't say follow-up care.
But follow-up care is defined by the statute, not by the expert. And the statute, as you read the statute, it shows that follow-up care has to be something that was provided by the same physician or dentist that directly provided the care that would be applicable pursuant to subsection 1.
So there'll be a jury instruction on that part of the statute and also an interrogatory as to whether or not the jury finds that this is applicable under the statute.
There could be, Your Honor, yes. And definitely,
no, it could be. I want to pin you down here.
As I read the order, follow-up care, the follow-up care issue has been established.
So there's going to be no issue of follow-up care in this trial?
There's no issue that this was follow-up care provided by Dr. Preston.
So the jury will be told this is follow-up care?
Correct. But whether or not the cap applies will be subject to a jury instruction, and those are facts that the jury is going to have to decide.
Because of the rebuttable presumption?
Correct.
And you don't think that follow-up care is a issue of fact in this matter under Wood versus Safeway, because this is a summary judgment. I mean, isn't it a fact that you take the evidence in the light most favorable to the party being moved against?
Your Honor, I didn't understand that was disputed, that this was, in fact, follow-up care. This is the same physician who provided the emergent immediate care. And all the definition in the statute is simply that a physician who provides follow-up care to that patient, this is subsequent care. I don't know how you define it differently.
And then the jury would be asked to make the finding under 2A whether that follow-up care occurred after the patient was stabilized or not. And if it was after the patient was stabilized, then the cap would not apply. And if it was before the patient was stabilized, it would.
Correct. And it goes further than that because it also goes to the argument that Dr. Preston knew or should have known that the way he performed that second surgery was inappropriate. So that would also be something that would be decided by the jury in determining whether or not this cap applies.
Could you address the issue of the propriety of writ relief, not as to the constitutional issues, but as to the construction of the order and the statute vis-à-vis the rebuttable presumption.
I would, Your Honor. And my my concerns with this being appropriate for writ review are twofold. The arguments are that they want to correct an error, that the case law is clear. This court has decided time and time again that that's not the purpose of writ review, to correct judicial error. This is a case that it's very premature. We don't know if the cap's going to even apply once the jury's done with it. But that aside, this would be appropriate for appellate review. There are many times, as a defense attorney, I take the opposite side as Mr. Janay. There's motions to dismiss we file that we think should be granted and that aren't, and it causes our clients to incur the expense of going through trial when we may get a defense verdict at the end, and maybe that should have been decided on a motion to dismiss. The expense is a risk. It's a risk of any litigation. With a cap or no cap, there's no guarantee that you're going to get an award in any event. The other point he makes is that this case or this statute has never been interpreted before. There are so many statutes out there, so many rules, a lot of them in the medical malpractice arena that have not been interpreted or reviewed by this court. It's inappropriate to do it at this time, and if you do, you're opening that floodgate. You're going to have any litigant who's upset about an interlocutory ruling by a district court on interpretation of a new statute is going to be before you on an extraordinary relief request. I guess there was one more prong to that argument, was that this is of statewide interest. Again, I would argue that all of this case in particular is a little unusual because it's not going to find itself in front of you, I don't think, very often, where we're dealing with this follow-up care surgical issue. But that that aside, it's always going to be important to a litigant. Like you pointed out, it's extremely important to them. This statute has been in effect for, gosh, a long time now, and I don't know that I've seen this issue. You probably know if you have or not, but this actual trauma follow-up care issue has not come before us before. I don't think it's of such statewide importance that there's this urgency to have it heard on a writ.
Well, I can just tell you, as a district judge, I had a case where a guy was paralyzed because the car went off the road, and he was taken to the emergency room, and they did the surgery. He became blind, you know, as a result of the surgery, and the jury awarded $20 million on it. So it's kind of a major issue, at least in my book, you know, how this applies. So I don't know how often this happens, but, you know, that's one case that comes to mind.
I agree, and Your Honor, and that goes to the constitutional issues that we haven't discussed here today and to the weighing of benefits and risks that the legislature did in promulgating these statutes.
I want to confirm, which is probably repetitive of the line of questioning that bantered between Justice Cherry and I, but in your mind, Judge Adams' order merely states that this was follow-up care, period, would therefore allow the subsection of 503, 41503, to be presented by way of expert testimony, considered by the jury in the form of a special interrogatory, and that in no way would Mr. Janay's client be limited to a $50,000 cap unless the jury first made a finding that this is follow-up care and therefore subject to the rather low cap.
Your Honor, I do believe the order could be clearer, and maybe a motion for clarification would have been appropriate, but the judge does specifically cite the subsection that talks about follow-up care and a rebuttable presumption. In my mind, that indicates that that's the section that he's applying, and that it would be a rebuttable presumption that would go to the jury. Absolutely.
So no limitation on what Mr. Janay's client could present in the form of information or dispute to the jury?
Sure. No, absolute, yes.
And what would be the special interrogatory that you agree would be appropriate on the issue of whether or not the cap applies?
Well,
I understand it's hard to draft on the fly, but in general.
No, I think as you would draft any rebuttable presumption cap, and the one that comes to mind right now for me is we just had a case in Las Vegas where there was a sanction of a spoliation issue, and there was a rebuttable presumption that the evidence would be considered detrimental to the other side, the side who lost it. I think it would be similar to that. There would be the rebuttable presumption that this cap applies if you find these things. And Mr. Janay would then say, but look, he was stable before this. And look, this doctor knew or should have known that this was the wrong approach. And those kinds of things are absolute exceptions to this cap.
But he could not go in and argue that this was not follow-up care that was directly related to the original traumatic injury.
Your Honor, he hasn't, again, I apologize, he can probably address this, but he hasn't made the argument that it's not follow-up care. I think it's pretty clear that there's no argument that it's follow-up care. It's whether or not
it's
that presumption.
It's just kind of odd the way the order was crafted. It indicates that the cap is going to apply. The way it was drafted, NRS 41503 states the cap will apply to, and then quotes, and then goes through and finds as a matter of law under subsection B those factors.
Sure, and again,
it's
I agree.
That's confusing.
It could have been more clear, and perhaps that's something Mr. Janay and I should do in the district court is go back and say, clarify this. We don't understand. Maybe that should have been done before we came before you here today.
So, Counsel, you're conceding that the question of the rebuttable presumption and its application is still a jury question?
No, Your Honor. I believe the application of the rebuttable presumption is established. I don't concede that that's not established by this order. I think what the court is intending to do here, what the district court wanted to do, is say that it applies. That section applies in this case. Mm-hmm. And now, plaintiff, you have the burden of proving that the cap shouldn't apply.
So the jury question is whether the plaintiff can overcome the rebuttable presumption.
Correct.
But that, you concede, is a jury question.
Yes, I do. And there are disputed facts as to that issue.
And you arrive at that conclusion because the statute itself defines follow-up care, and that was neither contested by the plaintiff, and the facts of this case fit within the definition.
Correct. And there was no dispute in terms of the facts that would apply, that would make Section 1 apply. And Section 1 has to apply for the Section 3 to apply. Thank you.
Counsel, we have you down at 201. Let's make it an even 3 minutes and see where we go.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're going to talk about, did you concede the follow-up care issues? So maybe we can start with
that.
That
was the question
that
I asked.
Yeah.
Well, there's a bigger question than that, because you... The respondent in this case didn't make a partial motion for summary judgment to get the application of the rebuttable presumption. He asked for the instruction at the time of trial, Your Honor. I mean, it's a rebuttable presumption. Those facts have been presented to the court. They made the partial motion for summary judgment to get the cap to apply, the $50,000 cap, and that's what this order effectively does. That order doesn't say, you have to twist your mind to get that order to say that... At the time of trial, we're going to have listened to all the facts. Your expert witnesses, Mr. Janay, are going to be allowed to testify to the full extent of all the damages, that they can dispute the issue of whether the care was emergent and whether it was follow-up care, and the defense is going to get a rebuttable presumption instruction. That's not what this order says. This order says conclusively that as a matter of law, 41503 applies, and you're capped. It took away whether it was a rebuttable presumption or not. The court found as a matter of law I couldn't rebut the presumption.
Respondent seems to concede that you may both need to go back before Judge Adams and get that particular paragraph clarified. And that may be a more direct route to resolve this case.
While I appreciate that, I've got an order in this from this court that I don't have the same confidence conceivably that... I guess I'm more practical. We're here. Let's solve it. And then secondarily, depending on what this court does, maybe we go back to the judge and say, we're a little bit confused by your order. Obviously, we're reading this order differently.
Mr.
Frankly, I don't know that every member of this court is reading it the same way. And that is a part of the problem here.
Mr. Janay, counsel argued that the care provided by your client, the care provided by the physician met the definition of follow-up care. Did you argue differently than that in the district court?
Clearly. The fair reading of our opposition, both Dr. Kabesh and Dr. Regan dispute the issue as to whether or not this is follow-up care as contemplated by 41503. And this is where the interpretation of the statute is somewhat vague as to what do they mean by follow-up care. He came into the hospital on September 10th, has the surgery on September 14th. The care that the second surgery performed by the respondent in this case arises as a consequence of the original injury. But at the second surgery, both of our doctors will testify that that is not follow-up care in the sense of...
But wait a minute. Let me pause you there for one moment. She seems to concede that whether this patient was stabilized is an issue of fact for the jury under Judge Adams' order. If she concedes that, does that eliminate your objection with respect to whether this is named follow-up care? Because the real question is, under the statute, is was the patient stabilized, not whether or not it was related to the original treatment.
That's correct. That's our argument, Justice Pickering, that the issue of follow-up care is the issue of whether or not he is stable and non-emergent at the time that the addition...
And I think she concedes that that remains to be an issue of fact, but what she's reading follow-up care to be is quite different from what you're reading it to be.
Well, clearly. I mean, the issue of follow-up care relates to this issue of, I mean, the same physician is doing, is treating the patient. That, I guess, would be considered follow-up care. That's not the factual issue in contention here, is whether he's non-emergent and whether he's stable. But what I'm more concerned about is that the defense is making concessions about that doesn't contain those concessions. I would love for the defense and I to get together and recraft the court's order. Unfortunately, I don't have that ability, and the consequence of applying 41503 as a blanket to us now, which is what they asked in their motion for summary judgment, partial motion for summary judgment. They didn't ask to apply the rebuttable presumption. Good Lord, you do that at the time of trial with an instruction. So the consequence is, as we sit here in the plaintiff's perception of the order, is we're capped.
Well, if counsel's gone on record conceding that it's just the rebuttable presumption they were seeking, that's what's applying, and you still got your exceptions available, you're not happy with that?
I'm never happy unless I get a court order that tells me that what I can do. My experience in 30 years of trying cases is that sometimes courts are a little funny about their orders.
Mr. Janay, I don't know if this ever, but I've been here 9 years, and I think I'm the longest serving justice. I've never seen this come up exactly, but... assuming the court could give you a procedure where you and Ms. Pine met for 30 days, see where you can agree upon the order, then advise us by letter, and I'm speaking for myself, but just throwing an idea that you have recrafted the order to that's mutually agreeable to you, then that would moot this request. If you haven't, for whatever reason, don't tell us why, but for whatever reason, then we would have to take some action on it. Is that a feasible solution?
Absolutely. It's very reasonable to me. Here's my only concern, and I'll have to... seek your advice is that I'm a little bit worried about two parties recrafting the court's order. I mean,
I think you have adequate representations made on the record here. I think that's what we're all trying to point to, is that certain concessions were made with respect to how this statute, at least how you both interpret the order and application of the statute, that might allow for subsequent revisionist history, perhaps.
Yeah, I think in the Wythe case, the both attorneys agreed to a jury instruction. The judge gave a different jury instruction. We still affirmed the judgment in this matter, but the jury instruction was wrong on
I would assume you two would enter into a stipulation, say it's hereby stipulated the order of Judge Adams is modified as follows, and lay it out. And if you both sign it, I think it's binding, if I remember correct. So
I'm more than willing to try. I will tell you that I'm a little anxious about two parties stipulating to amend a court's order, but I'll
I guess
give
it happened
try.
To me all the time, so maybe I wasn't like.
I never knew I could do it, and I'll do it more often.
Okay.
Don't cite to our authority for that, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. We thank counsel for this lively argument this morning, and we will have this matter submitted at this time. Thank you.